Today's edition of MTSU on the Record is an encore presentation dedicated to the memory of Dr. Tom Berg, a professor of electronic media communication who passed away last weekend. This broadcast originally aired on May 23, 2004.
Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. My name is Jenna Logue and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Today we're going to talk about a class that I understand has been offered since the year 2000 and will be offered again at MTSU this summer. And it sounds like a lot of fun, the kind of course you'd really want to take during the summer because you'd get a great deal of enjoyment out of it. Instead of watching reruns of sitcoms, you could study the history of TV sitcoms with Dr. Thomas Berg, who is here to talk about the class with us. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much, Jenna.
What is the educational value, though, of studying the history of TV sitcoms?
I think the educational value has to do with looking at society and how it's changed, really, since the beginning of the 1950s. A lot of the kids that I have as students now look at a sitcom from the 50s, and it seems very much a fiction to them. Of course, much of it is a fiction. But they are very, very surprised about how the 50s were or how the 60s were and what restrictions there were on television in terms of what could be shown and what could not be shown. I think the value of it, though, is for them to see particularly how stereotypes have been perpetuated. Of course, that's not limited only to situation comedies, but certainly reflected in the situation comedies as we have seen them through the history of television from, well, really 1948 on.
And how certain ethnic groups indeed are even conspicuous by their absence in the early days of
television. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Or if they're portrayed at all, they're portrayed as domestics. And that's something that is particularly true when you look at the very early 1950s. There were a couple of situation comedies on. The most famous one was really an outgrowth of a radio sitcom called
Amos and Andy.
And in Amos and Andy, of course, in radio, Amos and Andy were portrayed by two Caucasian gentlemen. When it moved over to television, they did have to admit to the fact that they had to have a black male portray each of the two main characters. There's another situation comedy called Beulah, which was about an African-American maid. But most of the racial characters, black characters of the early 1950s, were pretty much relegated to domestics, roles as domestics. You may remember Rochester from the Jack Benny program. Jack Benny program wasn't really a situation comedy per se, but it was a program nonetheless that had skits in it, and Rochester, of course, was the valet.
At least Eddie Anderson had some funny lines.
He did, but it was always boss.
Right.
Boss this, boss that. All right, and I think that when I play some of these situation comedies in class, I certainly see facial expressions indicating that they're wincing, maybe in some in pain at seeing these kinds of situation comedies, hearing some of the lines that were so much a part of the situation comedies, and I think it really helps them to see a society that's changed. Maybe hasn't changed enough, but has changed certainly in the 55 years since the beginning of television.
The NAACP raised Cain over the TV version of the Amos and Andy show, which showed people as either stupid or conniving, as in the case of the Kingfish, or shrewish, as in the case of Kingfish's wife. What was her name?
I can't recall, to be honest with you.
Anyway, and there was no Cosby Show. There was no Counterpoint. There was no show about a black lawyer, show about a black cop, show about a such and such and so and so. And if that was the only depiction of blacks, then it's not that an African-American actor couldn't play a stupid character, but if all the African-Americans were only allowed to play stupid characters, then you're not really showing life as it is, or an exaggerated version even of life as it is, as a sitcom is.
Very true.
I find myself agreeing more and more these days with the people who say that the sitcom as, I don't know, an art form, maybe that's a little too highfalutin to say, but the quality of sitcoms overall has declined, with a few notable exceptions, over the last couple of decades or so. You don't see, there is no one particular night that is really appointment television the way CBS's All in the Family, MASH, Bob Newhart, Mary Tyler Moore night used to be.
Well, I think Friends came closest to that. I think that came close to that. That is a situation comedy came closest to it. And certainly when I play Friends in my situation comedy class, there's instant recognition. I mean, my students are humming the tune and doing everything else, you know, with Friends. Mm-hmm. But I think you're correct in that situation comedy as a form on television has declined. I think part of it has to do with the fact that it's become very, very expensive to do situation comedies or any other kind of television program. And quite frankly, too, there are so many commercial interruptions now that it's difficult, I think, to sustain a storyline over a period of half an hour. When you're looking at a half an hour of television, you're looking at about really 18 or 19 minutes maximum of story time, and the rest of it is commercials or promos. That's quite a departure from what it was like in the earlier days of television, when you would have like 22, 23 minutes of program material for a half an hour situation comedy. So I think that has a lot to do with it too. But certainly it's in terms of appointment television. Cheers was another one that was kind of appointment television. Seinfeld was to some extent appointment television. But I think that now that the longer-running situation comedies, like Frasier, for example, another one that's going off the air after 11 years, and of course Friends, they're departing, and they've had a long run. Some might say too long, but there doesn't appear to be anything on the horizon to replace any of these, or either one of these. And I think that's troublesome to some network executives who have become, you know, kind of accustomed to having these great situation comedies and wonderful ratings, and now they're suddenly left with a big hole in the schedule.
It occurs to me that the TV sitcoms that are considered classics have been or will be, whether you're talking about Friends or going all the way back to the Dick Van Dyke Show, are set up with very simple premises. The most successful ones, The Cosby Show, it's a family. Boom.
Mm-hmm.
Ta-da.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. You know, that's it. Parents and kids. You know, there's nothing complex about the basics of it.
Well, and what made Cosby such a great situation comedy, in my opinion, is that it was all about situations. The humor grew out of situations rather than being a jokey, one-line kind of humor.
This is not take my wife, please, but on bump.
Yeah,
but seriously,
exactly.
Folks, I want to tell you.
Absolutely. And there were some, and I think that is the enduring quality of a show like The Cosby Show. The fact that it wasn't just a one-joke kind of show or a jokey kind of show week after week. Dick Van Dyke, another very good example. One thing that they're doing with the Dick Van Dyke Show and is showing an updated version of it. And that, of course, happened this past week. This, I think, is a mistake. You start to lose, I think, what the magic was about a particular show when you start to update it or say, well, where are they now? It's hard to go past 100%, you know, in terms of a sitcom and its quality. And I think the Dick Van Dyke Show was certainly a classic sitcom in that sense.
To say nothing of the fact that Maury Amsterdam and Richard Deacon are dead.
Exactly right.
And
exactly.
They were an essential part of the chemistry. I do like the kind of reunion show that has the actors sitting around and reviewing clips like the MASH 30th Anniversary Special.
I think that has more relevance, and I think it also helps the viewer understand why the situation comedy worked for its time. I think there needs to be a realization, perhaps there is, certainly on the part of the viewer, that when they start to see old sitcoms resurrected in a way that is too much like the old sitcom was, it's like trying to reinvent that wheel, trying to conjure up some comedy where maybe it would not be conjured up so easily.
Getting back to the 50s, if I could, for a minute, I Love Lucy, perhaps the most durable of all the sitcoms to come out of that period, succeeded, of course, in large part because Lucille Ball's extraordinary comedic timing and her willingness to take chances were unprecedented. But it would appear that until after his death, Desi Arnaz didn't get the credit that he deserved for reinventing or advancing the TV sitcom, both from a comedic standpoint and a technical standpoint.
He really was. And, of course, he had the simultaneous film cameras going, three or four simultaneously. He'd film things as they went. There was not a take two. It was filmed before a studio audience. And it was magic. He has only, as you say, after his death, been given the credit they should have been given a long time ago. Not only that, but he had some comedic timing of his own. He was a very talented comedian.
It's hard to play the straight man.
Well, it is very difficult, and off of Lucille Ball particularly, but you see these retrospectives, and you realize that one of the reasons I Love Lucy has endured is because everything about that show worked. The writing was crisp. It was, for the most part, non-topical, which made it work. They didn't talk about the Eisenhower administration or anything that was going on in the 1950s. It was very non-topical. I think that's one of the reasons why Dick Van Dyke worked. I Love Lucy is one of those shows that in the parlance of the trade is called an evergreen. It's a syndication term for a show that just keeps on working and working and working. No matter how many times it's shown around the world or on a particular TV station, it works. Another example of an evergreen is the Andy Griffith Show. Again, very non-topical, you know.
Which came out of that Danny Thomas stable, as did Dick Van Dyke.
Exactly. I mean, it was a Desi Lu production as well. So there was a lot of magic that came out of that stable, but the magic about it was that it had fine writing, great character development, and really lasting appeal. That's why students today will look at I Love Lucy and laugh. They'll look at Dick Van Dyke and laugh. They'll look at the Andy Griffith Show and genuinely get a kick out of it.
Because probably if they grew up in a small town in the South as I did, they'll recognize the exaggerated versions of some of those down-home folks in people that they've known.
Exactly, and you're absolutely correct. It is exaggerated. You know, there probably is not a Deputy Fife that is absolutely true to Don Knotts' character of Barney Fife.
But, or an Otis the Drunk who has Otis, the wherewithal to actually lock himself in the jail.
Very, very open door policy or open open cell policy in that particular case, and that seemed to work pretty well. But again, you look at these actors from Ronnie Howard to Don Knotts, Andy Griffith, Francis Bavier, all these folks who were just magnificent in the roles that they played. And the situations grew out. The comedies grew out of the situation. It wasn't, again, the jokey kind of thing with an overly rambunctious laugh track, which greatly offends me these days, even more so than ever before. You know, if I don't laugh by myself, then it's probably not funny, at least not to me. So why should I be helped along with a laugh track? Well, in some cases, that's the only funny thing about the show is the laugh track. It's so absurd.
Something else I like about the best sitcoms, and this is true from Dick Van Dyke to Frasier, is the ones that really stand the test of time, to me, do not talk down to the audience. They are intelligently written, and they're sophisticated. Van Dyke showed you the characters both at home and in the workplace, because that is, after all, your second family. And it didn't have to be topical or political in order to show that level of sophistication, that it wasn't all mom and apple pie, you know, that I have to deal with this other world as well as this domestic world.
I agree with that, and I think that that's what helped to make those shows really work. One of the criticisms of late of the Frasier show has been the fact that it's all been happening on the home front, where in the earlier days and throughout really much of the 90s, that show dealt not only with the home front, but with the work environment. It had some wonderful characters at work that could remind us of some of the people that we work with in one sense or another.
In his case, it's a radio station, and the neurosis of the whole self-help attitude or zeitgeist of the 90s, self-help books, self-help radio people, and this guy's telling people what to do and he can't control his own life. That's just inherently funny whether you put it in a radio station or someplace else.
And you throw somebody who is really competing with Frasier as his brother, and that would of course be Niles, and it becomes even funnier because they're both psychologists. They both have similar goals. They're both rather prissy in their attitude. They're kind of an embarrassment to their father, who was a police officer.
Somebody once called Frasier and Niles heterosexual sissies.
Well, you know, and I think that's probably a good term for them. And they were sissies throughout school. One of my favorite episodes of Frasier is when they hire a plumber, and the plumber comes. It turns out to be an old schoolmate that used to pick on Frasier and Niles all the time. And you know, Frasier and Niles tried to corner the plumber to make him feel bad for what he had done. It was a wonderful show. It was just, you know, again, well written, full of believable characters. Yes, exaggerated, but believable characters that we probably sometime during our lifetimes meet on the street.
But the sitcoms did start to get political and topical with, well, after the counterculture of the 60s, the taint of Vietnam and Watergate, and enter Norman Lear. Talk a little bit about how he revolutionized the sitcom.
Well, he absolutely did, and what makes it all the more fascinating was that All in the Family, which was based upon the British comedy Till Death Do Us Part, was originally turned down by CBS, and even after the second pilot was written and CBS reluctantly took it on, even after that, CBS was skittish. And in fact, as you may know, All in the Family nearly died in its first season on the air. In fact, it was a half a season. It debuted in January and was barely noticed. And had it not been for the sheer determination of Norman Lear to speak to Bill Paley, who was with CBS at that time, the show probably never would have gone anywhere. But this was a time which, to me, is very interesting in television history, because this was a time when CBS in particular had all the barnyard comedies on. It had Andy Griffith, but besides Andy Griffith, it had Green Acres, it had Petticoat Junction, it had all these rural kinds of shows.
I hated those programs. Hated them with a passion, because I said to myself, this and the dogs and the water hoses on the news is all that Northerners think about the South.
Well, there you go. So kind of a perpetuation of the Southern stereotype in this particular case. But so what was refreshing then was, here was something that came out of the Norman Lear factory, very, very out in left field. politically speaking, pushed the envelope like nothing had ever been pushed before, and it was called All in the Family. And once it did catch on, it caught on in a big way. Of course, it spun off other programs like Maude and the Jeffersons, and other programs that were similar in tone to All in the Family. What's interesting to me about it today, as I teach it in the sitcom class, is that, again, there is something of a discomfort on the part of students in listening to the language and the attitudes that were purveyed by Archie Bunker, for example, or conveyed by Archie Bunker on All in the Family. They look upon it as perpetuating stereotypes instead of helping stereotypes. Where at the time, Archie became kind of known as America's best loved bigot. How do you love a bigot? Some of my students will ask that question. How do you love somebody like that? And it's one of those shows that I think worked best in its time. And it still works for those of us who lived through that time and who watched the show when it was brand new and can look back at it now, listen to the language, listen to some of the attitudes that are conveyed in the show and say, that still is funny to us. It's funny to us because we understand the time that was in.
And if they watched All in the Family, if they'd had the opportunity to watch it over the length of the series run as we had, mm-hmm. I think they would have seen the writers soften Archie gradually as the series progressed. Not necessarily soften his bigotry per se, but make people realize that, well, humanize him because of his love for Gloria, because of his love for Edith. Realize that this is not an evil man. This is just a very, very flawed human being who's the product of his upbringing, and he's not all bad.
Exactly.
He's just got his dumb spots.
Well, that certainly is true. And you look at somebody like Maude, who was the liberal equivalent of Archie Bunker. I mean,
Was just as big a pain in the butt sometimes.
And she was as big a bigot because she went the other direction and she was bigoted toward men, for that matter. I mean, she'd had failed marriages and so on and so forth. So she was kind of polar opposite in terms of a political ideology as from Archie Bunker, but there were many similarities between those two characters. They were bigoted in their own ways. They were flawed human beings in their own ways. But I think that this was something that really helped to bring about a whole generation of television shows that start to look at more at issues, start to look at women's rights, for example, start to look at, well, take another good example, I think, would be Mary Tyler Moore. You know, came out of the Grant Tinker factory, and of course she was married to Grant Tinker at the time. This was another show, I think, that really kind of pushed the envelope for its time, not so much because of the language it used, but in the growth of Mary Richards, the character, from being somebody who says, I'm spunky, and Lou Grant says, I don't like spunk, to somebody who would stand up to Mr. Grant and somebody who would assert herself as a professional newswoman in the television operation.
The very concept of a single female who had a career and was pretty and was dating from time to time, but not necessarily rushing out to find Mr. Wright and desperate to find Mr. Wright, mm-hmm. was a novel concept for its time in and of itself.
Well, it was novel in the sense, too, that there were some questions that were left unanswered about Mary Richards.
Did she ever go to bed with any of her dates?
That's exactly right. Did she ever go to bed with anybody? Well, it was never really portrayed one way or the other. It wasn't even really suggested, but it was left to our imaginations, which I think some people still to this day kind of long for in a situation comedy that doesn't necessarily draw us the entire picture, but leaves something to our imaginations. I think that's what made Hitchcock a master of his craft. Was that he left things to our imagination. We didn't see the grisly murder, but there's nothing probably more shocking even today than the shower scene in Psycho, because there was so much that was suggested in that scene, so much that we could paint with our own brush. We didn't have to have it painted for us. I think the same thing is true of situation comedies.
And if a character in a sitcom is a partially empty vessel, then we, the audience, can project our own feelings and what we're going through in our own real lives onto that character. Mm-hmm. And there's sort of a... But you have to have that with a character that you're actually welcoming into your home. It's different from going into a movie theater where you're not on your own home turf. If you're welcoming someone into your home, that person has to be special. And that's true for the sitcom family, too, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And you might welcome the person into your home or the situation comedy in your home for a trial run. That trial run may not run any more than 1 week because you've seen it and you say, you know, I hate this, or I don't like the way they get the laughs in this program. I don't like the way the thing has been... produced. Any number of things. I mean, a number of things that we could find fault with would cause us not to turn or tune to the sitcom the next week.
Could a sitcom like MASH survive today? We were wanting, perhaps too desperately back then, to find parallels between the Korean War, which MASH depicted, and the Vietnam War, which we were struggling with. Could a comedy about war survive in the current climate?
I don't think it could. And I think that one of the problems I have with MASH, I'll probably be attacked for this by somebody, but I think that that MASH was very much overrated as a television program. I think it was on much, much too long. I think that it was closer to a dramedy, as to use a term that was popular in the late 80s to describe situation comedies that were also dramas. I think it was closer to that than it was a comedy. I don't really include MASH as a situation comedy in the truest sense of the word. Now, getting to your question, no, I don't think a show like that could survive very well. And in fact, one of the points that's made by the producers of MASH is that it was more based upon the Korean War, really, the Vietnam War than the Korean War. The Korean War was what it was supposed to be based on, but the attitudes that were shown in MASH were more Vietnam attitudes. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it would. I don't think it really would survive. I could be wrong on that, though. Mm-hmm.
I divide it into halves. I didn't like the McLean Stevenson years, and I liked the Harry Morgan years. I think it got better as it grew. I think it got to be fewer hijinks at the front, as Alan Alda said, and more into, there was a little more depth there. Going back to race very quickly, we've seen with the explosion of cable, we've seen the WB and the UPN, and this has given more outlets for black shows, but not all African Americans like the kind of black sitcoms that have been going on cable these days. One of the Wayans brothers called the WB the Wee Black Network, and there aren't too many Cosby shows on those networks. They show black people, but some African Americans are not crazy about the way they're being depicted in those sitcoms. Could you address that just briefly?
Well, I think that a situation on the WB where some of the situation comedies, especially those that pretend to address black issues, simply do not have the depth that they should. I don't think that they have the forethought that there should have been in developing the situation comedy. And I think that sometimes they take off on characteristics that in many cases cause a stereotypical kind of reaction anyway. And I've talked to some of my African-American students who, you know, will either feel very strongly one way or another about certain situation comedies that they're seeing now that aspire to portray the African-American experience.
and it comes off as a caricature in some ways with regard to the depiction of the whole rap music culture. And we could go on and on about this. Unfortunately, we are running short of time, and I hate that because it's a very interesting subject. History of TV sitcoms being taught this summer at MTSU by Dr. Thomas Berg. Thanks for joining us
today. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
I'm Jenna Loke. This is MTSU on the Record. Please join us next week at this same time.